Hello, and welcome back to Speaking Refugee, the Vulner podcast. My name is Sham Jaff, and I'm happy that you tuned in our six-part podcast series in which we explore the different meanings of vulnerability.
It's not about if they are blood relative. It is those who share the experience with you. You kind of can be vulnerable.
To be honest, handling two babies at the same time is not easy.
Having a family, I say it is an achievement.
This podcast is a part of the Vulner Project, a research project that aims to understand the vulnerabilities faced by migrants, to enable decision makers to better identify situations of vulnerabilities and address them. For this purpose, the Vulner research teams have conducted fieldwork in different countries in Europe, North America, the Middle East, and Africa to reach a better understanding of the vulnerabilities as lived by the migrants themselves. They met with social workers and talked to migrants. In this podcast series, we bring you testimonies from migrants in Uganda and Belgium and from a social worker in Lebanon. They testify on the main life challenges that the migrants face there. In episode 1 of this series, we explained why that matters and how vulnerability as a concept is important on so many levels of the migration process of refugees worldwide. If you haven't listened to that episode, we recommend you do that first. Vulnerability has been increasingly used in the legal and policy instruments of several asylum systems around the world. This means that social workers, public servants deciding on asylum decisions, and asylum judges have to assess information about how vulnerable a person is. Sometimes those decision makers are only able to capture the more serious things, such as disabilities. Less visible needs are more difficult to discover. Vulnerabilities caused by what happened in their home country or on the journey are often not easy to voice. To assess those aspects of vulnerability, more individual support and assistance is often needed before many refugees are able to open up about difficult experiences and feelings. In this podcast, we want to do exactly that. We want to focus on the individual experiences and feelings that constitute the vulnerability of refugees in different countries that are often overlooked and not so clear. We bring together scientific fieldwork and the stories of refugees themselves. We wanted to know, how does vulnerability show at the different stages of the migration process? We've already met Jamila, who is a refugee from Afghanistan and currently in an accommodation center in Belgium.
I wasn't expecting to be alone here in this situation, new area, new people, new language.
Gabriel, who has a refugee history himself and is now working with refugees in Uganda.
Well, one of my wishes when I was young, I was like, I should have a family.
And we talked to Fatima, a humanitarian worker in the MENA region with Besme and Zaytune. One of the areas of concentration is Lebanon.
It's so rewarding in the sense, these like, you know, few hours, it's not just like, you know, about what you are bringing to yourself. It is about what you are offering to others.
Today, we will be talking about the meaning of family. As we learned last time, when talking about home, family plays a very important role in terms of feeling secure or even happy. To many people, it is the primary place where they feel attachment and love. For both Gabriel and Jamila, feeling at home was deeply connected to their families. Family. What does that mean to you? Family. Maybe your parents or grandparents or your siblings, your kids. Some people say that family is wherever there are children. Or does family mean something broader to you, like a human connection to certain people you can trust, love, or people that you can rely on?
In these displacement settings, it's not about if they are blood relative. It is those who share the experience with you, around you, and whom you can tell your story and know that they went through something similar and they can give you advice on how to move forward, or like you kind of can be vulnerable.
This is Fatima. She's working as a social worker in Lebanon. At least that's one of her jobs. In her view on family, this does not necessarily have to do with being blood relatives, but in her view, it has a lot to do with being able to show one's vulnerable side. It is a bunch of people who know you, have your back, and assure you that you are not alone, no matter what.
When you talk to refugees, there is a sense of uncertainty, like displacement in the sense not only physical displacement, but like they were deprived of their context, what they are used to, you know, they know their neighbors, their safety groups, their parents, their immediate family, whether, you know, they lost them to death or to war or to being apart. Someone, you know, would travel to another country and someone would stay in a certain destination. And there is also a sense of lack of stability. Like, do I get too invested in this context, in this country where I live, or am I going to be moved out of it? And that affects your immediate relation. Many express that they felt the pressure of living in a small apartment or in a small informal settlement setting. They live in a close proximity with their family. They don't have any privacy, but this is what they know. This is what they have to stick to.
Fatima is from Syria. And in her work, she meets a lot of people who have fled the civil war in Syria. According to the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, Lebanon remains the country hosting the largest number of refugees per capita in the world, with the government estimation of 1.5 million Syrian refugees and some 13,715 refugees of other nationalities.
For many Syrians, when they left Syria, they fled war, they fled inequality, they fled lack of opportunity, fear, you know, coming to Lebanon, I guess, some were able to capitalize on the opportunities or identify possible opportunities, make friends that they called family. They were able to kind of access certain work opportunities.
Fatima told us that many Syrian refugees, when meeting others from their home country, immediately try to connect with them. She often observes an urgent need to connect with someone with maybe similar experiences. Fatima thinks this might be in reaction to perceived loneliness and insecurity and vulnerability. When refugees left their families behind and come alone, she observes them trying to find other people, people who could somehow substitute their families and support each other in all of those difficult situations they have to face.
We cannot forget that, you know, there were many Lebanese people who were very supportive, and they kind of took in those people who were coming on their own. They didn't know how to access services. And here, services, I'm not just saying the aid services, like how do I access education if I want to restart over, you know, how can I rent a house, who do I talk to, you know, where can I sleep the first few nights, and so on. So there was a lot of support of the host community, of course, and, you know, those who would just like meet along the way, other refugees also traveling, and they just become family, as I said, because they have shared the interest of not having anything, you know, and trying to find something. So that is beautiful to see.
In building new connections and relationships that resemble the ones many people have in their families, many refugees can develop the resilience to cope with the challenges they face on their journey. Not being alone is central. Having support, sharing positive emotions, and finding ways of adapting to whatever comes together, it is easy to see how families are a tool to deal with vulnerability.
My childhood in Tanzania was really interesting. First of all, I was young, and I found myself in a place where I would meet many children. As our children, we would live a happy life, interacting with different children, playing together, playing football, acrobatics. And the good thing, we were all Burundians, almost 98% were Burundians. The language used was familiar to each other. Though challenges with the parents who were taking care of us, yeah, that one I cannot forget, because though I was a child or young, I could see how my mom would hustle.
Remember Gabriel? Gabriel lives in Uganda now. Fleeing Burundi in the early 90s, he has lived in various refugee camps. He has practically grown up in the Naki Valley refugee settlement in Uganda, where he is now working as an aid worker and as a teacher. He teaches English to refugees under the Access to Justice program, Speak Your Rights. It is a program that focuses on helping refugees learn how to request for their legal rights. Gabriel remembers his childhood in Tanzania, which he describes as carefree. But his mother, who had to feed three children on her own, had to work very hard. Often, when he woke up in the morning, she had already gone off to work.
She would go to work in people's homes, in people's gardens, to get what to eat. And she would come back late evening.
When she was at work, he was responsible for making food for himself and his siblings. When she came home late, he wanted everything to be ready. He knew that she did everything she could for her kids, and he tried his best to give back as much as possible. His father was absent.
In 1996, that's when my dad was like, he decided to go and work far from home. She packed everything in the morning and he told us that I'm going to work, but I'll be coming back after 6 months. After going, she didn't come back. We waited 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, up to now. We don't know where he is.
Gabriel somehow got used to this, but he used to think a lot about his whereabouts in his 20s. He also thinks about him today.
Did he die? Where is he? What is he thinking about us? Is he in prison?
As many kids of single moms, Gabriel has a very close relationship to his mother. When we talked, he recalled many beautiful memories with her.
We grew up with her in that way of not blaming one another. As a family, she prays to us like that. And one day when I was in high school, it happened I didn't have enough funds to continue with the school. I first called her. She told me, "You come. There's nothing you can do. You come and see what we can do." I told her, "I have no money, but I'm not sick. I can work for the money." She told me, "Let us do it together." We worked and worked. At least we were able to raise a half of that money, and I went to school. Another time I can't forget, when she was going to Australia. It was my first time to say bye to my mom at the airport. And I couldn't understand what was taking place. But I was happy at the same time, feeling like crying.
In 2019, his mom went to Australia.
My sister was married. Then it happened in UNHCR identified the husband. for resettlement. So when they went there, they went all with our documents, my documents, my mommy's document, and theirs. They submitted all documents. So I don't know the procedures they used. They only selected my mom to go with them.
His mom has a telephone, and Gabriel talks to her a lot. So going to Australia was really good for his mom. And Gabriel dreams of maybe someday joining her.
Yeah, actually, that's my big plan. We're trying to do family reunification, but I don't know. It's taking long. We had submitted in our application, but we haven't got any feedback.
Uganda, where Gabriel lives with his family now, is often praised as a model country for refugee protection. The country has implemented many of the international conventions to protect refugees, such as the 1951 Geneva Convention or the 1969 Refugee Convention by the Organization of African Unity. Uganda has also ratified many international conventions on children's and women's rights, and it has a strong protection for families. Uganda currently hosts 1.28 million refugees, 60% of whom are children. As the Volna Project's first report about Uganda, written by Sophie Nakuera, shows, the country has a specific way of offering individual services based on the individual needs of people with children or special types of families assessed by aid workers. The report cites an aid worker who works for Food is Life, an implementing partner that distributes food to protection seekers in the settlement.
When it comes to vulnerable persons, we have specific groups. We have got a section on nutrition and livelihood, where we basically prioritize extremely vulnerable people to be beneficiaries. For example, we give vegetables to pregnant mothers, young children who are minors, child-headed families, to ensure that they improve their health, and we go ahead to teach them how they can grow their food, so that away from our services, they know how to maintain their health.
Remember, some say family is wherever there are children. That means if you want to protect a child, you have to protect its family. Or, as the UNHCR puts it in its Keeping Families Together program, child protection promotes the right of every child to grow up in a nurturing family environment. Unfortunately, many refugee children lose one or both parents when they flee. As the aid worker mentioned, they're so-called child-headed families. Many of them are run by 14-year-olds. As you can imagine, this makes the members of such families vulnerable in a special way. In Uganda, the child protection law includes people that are assigned to those families. They are called alternates. Those alternates protect the children, for example, when they get food at the service points of a settlement. But Uganda also follows the UNHCR ideal to reunite families who have been separated for whatever reason. In an interview for the Volna Research in Uganda, a refugee status interviewing officer told us that they always try their best to reunite unaccompanied children with their parents. He's also cited in the report.
When we register them and you are a child, we enter that data into a system. Through our teams, a mother can say, "I am looking for my child who fled on this day." You look in the system and they are maybe in a different settlement, and the mother requests that she wants to be with her child, and there is family reunification.
Usually, the task of tracing and reuniting children with their families is the role of Reunite Global Incorporated, an international agency. However, from the example we just heard, we see that having such a database, which stores the biodata of refugees and asylum seekers across different settlements, is also crucial for a successful reunification. So the efforts made by Ugandan aid workers, they are a very good example of how to recognize the needs and vulnerabilities of children in regards of their families, especially regarding missing family members.
If you were a child who would be kind of forced into an early marriage, that would make you even more vulnerable.
Fatima, the aid worker, has also encountered other challenges that especially children might face.
Being a child as well, you know, like not having access to your basic right of education or like proper education, the experiences that you go through at this early age, you know, what you are exposed to, the stress, the tension, and being deprived of your kind of a safe space where you can play and be a child. Many children are kind of, you know, they have to work to provide to their families or to support their families. You know, many children are heading a household when, you know, they have to take care of other children in the family. Those are the most, you know, like vulnerable amongst all.
On top, some are experiencing problems with food supply.
Many children with malnutrition have been identified, and it is an increasing issue.
And there is the mother from episode 1 that Fatima had told us about. She had problems getting her residency approved in Lebanon, which had an effect on her children too.
She started working in cleaning, and then she had to send one of her children to work. So he was engaged in child labor. The majority of the income that this kid was making was going to transportation, basically, maybe a daily meal for the child himself.
Not meeting the basic needs of a family, like a home, enough food and money or education, it puts them in risk of being very vulnerable.
I'm busy with these two kids from the morning to evening, giving them food, feeding them, changing nappies, and taking them out and playing with Elias, because more than everybody, she needs me this time. I have to play with him also.
Remember Jamila from Afghanistan? She left her parents behind, and she lost her husband on the way to Europe when in Greece, a smuggler faced them with a difficult choice.
Smuggler said that I can carry only one person by plane. So you choose. So he decided to give the opportunity to me. Because I was pregnant, I could not go longer. I could not go more.
She doesn't know where her husband is today.
I'm just praying that one day he would be with me, inshallah. I just praying from my God, yeah, that he would be here with me. With my kids.
She has tears in her eyes when she tells us her last words to him.
Be careful, be safe. It was the last word.
Jamila is with her two kids. Her daughter, Hadia, is 7 months old. Her son, Ilyas, is 2 years old. The two pretty much determine everyday life for Jamila in the Belgium settlement. She told us that whenever one of them is awake, she has to be awake too. We couldn't help but recognize her sleepiness when we talked.
These are getting much harder. Being as a single mom is, I think, the most difficult experience. To be honest, handling two babies at the same time, same stage, when they need their mama for the same time is not easy. When she was crying, Elias was also crying with her, that she wake me up. So I was also crying with them.
Shortly before we talked, her little son had fallen from the bed. She hadn't watched him for 5 seconds, as she tells us.
5 seconds, because I had to get the milk for the another baby. So he just fell down from bed. So that's why from that time, even not half second, I'm leaving them alone.
But despite being tired much of the time and not getting all the things done that she wants to do, she's so full of love and very happy to be with her children. She really enjoys the time they have.
It's a good time. It's a precious time.
Still, being a single mom refugee, as you can imagine, it is hard. Jamila is responsible for everything. Her son, who fell from the bed, he might need to see a doctor. She is really concerned, and we can see tears in her eyes. Again.
No, I wasn't expecting to be alone here in this situation. New area, new people, new language. I have to learn language in this age. So I haven't expected. I wasn't thinking of this.
Jamila misses her family very much. When she talked about home in our first episode, she recalled the moments with her family were the good times in her life. Maybe you remember her saying,
"My family were an open-minded family, so they were also educated. My dad was bachelor math, and also my mom. My sister is journalist. So my dad told me, choose your own." Good things maybe happen shorter in life. All the time it is about difficulties, worrying, problems. And good things maybe has a short life in our lives. And the good thing, when I was with my family, my husband, so being a complete family and remembering everything from that is the most beautiful things in my life.
Some members of her family live in London, but as Great Britain is no longer part of the European Union, there are fewer possibilities to meet with them. Sometimes they can come meet her, but they are only allowed to meet for 2 or 3 hours. She wishes to live with them. But Great Britain has a very strict refugee law, mostly trying to avoid refugees coming to the country or even sending them to Rwanda before applying for asylum.
Today, the United Kingdom and Rwanda have signed a joint new migration and economic development partnership. This is part of the United Kingdom's new plan for immigration to control our borders, protect our communities, stop dangerous illegal migration, help the world's most desperate people.
Said Priti Patel, then Home Secretary under Boris Johnson, after the deal with Rwanda was signed. The UNHCR criticizes the British government for its restrictive refugee laws. Their new approach to asylum, UNHCR says, undermines established international refugee protection law and practices. The chances to be allowed to settle in the country are low, even if it was for a family reunion. The organization Refugee Action writes,
"The UK's current refugee family reunion rules are very restrictive. They exclude the complex relationships that affect families torn apart by war. For example, people caring for orphaned younger siblings or unaccompanied children who've been separated from their parents. This means refugees who have reached safety can find it almost impossible to bring their dependent family members to join them in the UK."
As we learned earlier, one of the basic rights of children, at least according to the UN Refugee Agency, is being together with their family. Vulnerabilities, as we can now see, are also results from countries not acting according to this basic right. In Jamila's case, the possibility of moving to London and be with other family members who could help her with the kids, that just doesn't exist.
In Afghanistan, I have only my mother and my sister. And my mother is also sick. Maybe you know about the Alzheimer. She has Alzheimer. Maybe last stage. I lost my father on 2 years ago, I lost my father due to this COVID. My father also had Parkinson's disease.
Her aunt and her granddad also died from Alzheimer's disease. Her mother, whom she talks to every day, has been sick for 5 years now.
My mom cannot recognize us, cannot speak, but just she's watching us silently, quietly.
Jamila's sister is caring for their mom. They live together without a man in the house. As Jamila tells us, this makes life much harder in Afghanistan. The illness of her mother worries Jamila a lot. Her sister tries to shield Jamila from the bad news about her mother.
It's about 3 weeks that my mom was admitted to hospital. So I wasn't also aware because my sister didn't tell me. She thought that I'm alone here with my kids.
Jamila herself tries not to mention to her sister how alone she feels in Belgium. She doesn't want her to worry either. So each of the sisters has to carry her own load by herself and alone. As Fatima, the aid worker, mentioned earlier, family and not being alone is a factor of resilience. Being alone on the other side is a factor of vulnerability. Let's get back to Gabriel again. Having a family was something that he has wished for, and also something that changed who he was, as he told us.
One of my wishes when I was young, I was like, I should have a family. And me seeing today having a family, I say it is achievement. I've achieved what I wished. I become more responsible. So like the way I was before I married is not the way I am today. I'm responsible.
His wife came to Uganda in 2015. She was from Burundi. At that time, he was working as a translator for OPM. That is short for Office of the Prime Minister. It is part of Uganda's governmental humanitarian operation.
We could receive different people every day, many different people. So it happened, my wife was there. Among the people we are receiving, I was helping to interpret. So I interpreted for her. That very first time, I didn't have any idea. I didn't have any crush on her because there were so many people. So she got done with her interviews. Then like 2 months later, I was walking around. I met her. She first greeted me in Swahili. She didn't know that, she couldn't remember that I would speak Kirundi because everyone here says that I look like Ugandans. I don't look like Burundians. She had some issue with the where she got a document. There were some names which are not written very well. She wanted to be edited. So she was trying to ask me because she saw me in the same office if I could help. So I told her, it's easy, let us keep in touch.
So this was where it started.
I helped her, but later after, we kept on chatting, talking on phone, whatever. So in my plans, I didn't know that was going to happen. So the conversation went beyond. So one day we met and we talked, like we shared life experience, where she came from. Really, that kind of love started developing there, coming out of that. So that's how we met.
Gabriel then went back to Kampala, where he got sick. As she heard about his sickness, she followed him to be there for him and take care of him. They married in 2015. Although having married and having started a family is an achievement for him, Gabriel also experiences some difficulties because of his own history as a refugee and because of the place where he is now, the settlement. And despite his new role, he's not primarily a refugee anymore, but a teacher. He sometimes struggles with this situation too.
Actually, here, staying in refugee life is something challenging. Like when I'm talking, when I'm happy, when I'm smiling, you may think that you have no problems, whatever. But when I think of my future plan with my family, I also become challenged. I think of putting my daughter in a good school, but when it comes to the income, my income cannot do it.
In Gabriel's view, in Uganda, good education is still connected to having enough money. At this moment in his life, he doesn't think that the money he earns by teaching is enough. But we will come back to this topic later in our episode on capital. To assess the needs of families who are more vulnerable and to provide all children with good education is the aim of many organizations working in Uganda. One of them is Windle International, a non-governmental agency tasked with implementing the educational needs of refugees. As the program manager of education said, according to the Vollner report on Uganda,
"Education is protection in itself. It liberates them. We make education accessible to them free of charge. For us, that is protection because after that we have refugees who are self-employed or employing others."
Windle concentrates on children with what they call special needs. Their focus with respect to vulnerability is on people with mental and physical disabilities, which does not account for many other children. Another organization, Sophie Nakuera, the author of the Vollner Report on Uganda, spoke to is War Child Canada. They focus on children who dropped out of school. As in many countries where the Vollner Project is researching and conducting interviews in, vulnerability often focuses on families and children with urgent needs. These examples highlight again, as we mentioned in our first episode, less visible needs are more difficult to discover. Fatima, the humanitarian worker in Lebanon, told us how the assessment of vulnerability usually works in the region she has been working on.
Vulnerability would be identified based on the context that they are living in. Like, what would it mean for a refugee living in Beqa to be the most vulnerable? You know, depends on the number of the family members, on which, whether they live in a informal tented settlement or whether they live in a house or an apartment or whether they live within the city. How many family members you would have in your family? What type of disabilities do you have? Elderly? How many children at school do you have? These are questions that, you know, I think, or the, let's say, the selection criteria that, you know, are set to ensure that, you know, the most vulnerable are reached. And each of these criteria is given a weight.
The Vollner Project shows that, generally speaking, vulnerability assessments, as they are conducted by public servants and social workers to target the aid response, are uneven, and that their concrete effects often depend largely on the discretion of the public servants in charge. Also, whereas Uganda is mostly praised for its very good refugee aid programs, the opposite is true for many other countries. For example, Great Britain, but also Lebanon, that tries to avoid giving residency permission to many Syrian refugees, as we learned in episode 1. In the asylum process in Europe, there's also an overall trend of reducing vulnerabilities to immediate and practical needs, which can be swiftly identified, such as access to specific healthcare for a pregnant woman, or the conduct of the asylum interview in a room that is accessible to a person using a wheelchair. While addressing immediate and practical needs is crucial to the well-being of asylum seekers, it shouldn't prevent a more comprehensive approach to their vulnerabilities where these are present. Some deeply rooted vulnerabilities may be voiced only at later stages, after the initial registration of the asylum application, once the required sense of trust has been established and the necessary observations have been made. One more finding of the Vulner Project is vulnerabilities, as understood by policymakers in the EU countries, may sometimes seem stereotyped and out of touch with refugees and asylum seekers' own understandings of their life challenges. They may often not identify themselves as vulnerable, nor consider that the focus on vulnerabilities reflects their actual needs and everyday life challenges. To prevent such a mismatch, it is essential to develop and implement vulnerability assessments that are attentive to how asylum seekers and refugees experience their vulnerabilities and cope with them. This requires that asylum seekers and refugees not be reduced to victim status, and that their agency be recognized despite constraints, knowing, however, that some of their vulnerabilities can stem from broader structural factors that they can't control, such as global inequalities. As we have seen in this episode, family can be a source of resilience to everyone who faces any struggle in life, and having a family, if by blood or by choice, is one important way to deal with vulnerability for many refugees. Helping each other, having similar experiences, and having someone to talk to when feeling helpless or overwhelmed, those are just some of the aspects family means to many, many people. The key element is togetherness, not being and not feeling alone. That is why the UNHCR makes keeping families together or reuniting them a priority in their refugee policy. Fatima told us that children are more in danger of becoming most vulnerable, especially when they are orphaned, were separated from their families, or live in a family with no legal residency status. We have heard of child-headed families, child labor, and malnutrition. In Jamila's case, we can see how challenging the single fact of being alone can be. And the same accounts for her sister back in Afghanistan. Both caretakers without helping hands, both left alone with a lot of responsibility. At least they can talk on the phone. And Gabriel's story is a success story to him because he has his own family now, and that changed his life. The vulnerability that he has to face now? He worries that he will not be able to afford his daughter a good education. We will discuss the money aspect of vulnerability in one of the upcoming episodes. This was the second of 6 episodes of Speaking Refugee, the Vulner Podcast. In the upcoming episodes, we will explore more facets of vulnerability, like food, gender, capital, or health. We will do this together with Fatima, Gabriel, and Jamila. We hope you'll join us again. My name is Sham Jaff. Until next time. Credits. The Vulner Project is carried out by an international research consortium involving partners from 9 research institutions located in 6 different countries. It is financed by the EU under the Horizon 2020 work program. This episode was designed by Haus 1, Karina Schröder, Sham Jaff, Katharina Alexander, and Katrin Rönicke, based on the input from the Vulner team, Susanne Höb, Luc Leboeuf, Zoe Krien, Maria Malouf, and Sophie Nakuera. Editing and sound design, Karina Schröder. Script, Katrin Rönnecke. Music by Blue Dot Sessions.